This is a production of Cornell University.
There's a lot of stuff that happens outside of you. So people do have an issue with the
restaurant. All right, let's get started if we could. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Can we take a roll of the membership, please?
Adam Howell.
Here.
Andy Barrantos Gomez.
Here.
Carolyn Levine.
Here.
Charles Van Loan.
Here.
David Heiner. Ellis Lowe. Gavin Martin.
Here.
Jeff B.
Here.
Joseph Anderson.
Here.
Christopher Barth.
Here.
Logan Kenny.
Present.
Hilary Thompson.
Here.
Rennell Mensah. Richard Bensel.
Here.
Robert Howard.
Here.
Jiang Wan Chin. Uchenne Chukwu Ter.
Okay. Thank you. We have a quorum. I'd like to welcome Carolyn Levine, a new member. Welcome.
Thank you.
Are there any calls for late additions to the agenda? There are none. We'll move on because it's a fairly full agenda. Approval of the minutes from January 21.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion on that? Without objection, we'll approve the minutes. Jeff, the floor is yours. UA member updates and changes.
So as Bob kind of alluded to, there's some changes in terms of membership and in terms of some chairships. So first off, I want to welcome Caroline again, and also Uche, who's not here, to the University Assembly. Both of them are new members as of now. There's also been a change in terms of the chair, in terms of the CJC. Logan has decided to kindly step down, and then Joe Anderson is now the new chair of the CJC. Besides that, that's pretty much all the updates. If you still have issues with vacancies, let me know.
Okay. Thank you both to Logan for your hard service over the time you did it, and to Joseph for stepping up.
That puts us way ahead of agenda because Martha comes next and she's not here. We're way too efficient.
We can wait till some. We don't really want to bring up the divestment resolutions this time, I don't believe. Joe, do you want to start to talk about
Yeah.
We'll cut you off when Martha comes and pick it up again.
Yep. So I just sent out through the listserv kind of the two documents that we've been working off of as the CJC in regards to what the spring 2020 calendar is going to look like in terms of deadlines for us, in terms of when the public forum is, and kind of the timeline. So all the members know, like, where in this code process are we going to be at and what's happening next. And so it's really a collaboration between the CJC and University Council kind of passing documents back and forth. Until our public comment section. And so public comment we have from March 13th through April 3rd with four different public forum dates, a fifth one waiting to be kind of looked at in terms that is more friendly to employee and faculty schedules. That was like a lunch forum that we're gonna do with like HR at the university. So like if people have questions like how does this affect like HR policies, it doesn't because it's going to be a student code, hopefully. So you'll no longer be under it. And so we'll just have there to have answers. So March 13th through April 3rd, that's public comment. The 2 weeks classes are in session in the last week of public comment, that's spring break. So we're going to hopefully utilize like the online message board really during that time. And we just cut that week open, you know, like that week as public comment because it would serve no purpose for us either way. And so then we would go from April 17th, April 3rd to April 17th, the CJC would make the edits based off the public comments. April 17th, we would send all of our edits to University Council's office. They would give it back. We would finalize April 24th and send it to the UA on April 24th. We are going to formally request that the UA do consider an additional meeting on April 28th. I think this we have to have this because we have to introduce the code and then wait to our next meeting, which would be the May 5th meeting, to vote on the finalization of the code. This would help, one, provide all of you a time to learn what those changes are in the code on the April 24th meeting, so we could really devote time to your questions, so you can kind of see what's going on, I mean, the April 28th meeting, so you could really get a holistic overview of what that code is, and then it gives you time between April 28th and May 5th to reach out to, like, me or individual committee members to get our, like, more opinions, answer, get some more clarifying questions for everyone, and so May 5th, we could actually, you know, have that final vote for the UA. We're also considering two tentative Saturday retreats for the committee, which would be all day Saturday. One is February 29th, but that would be us working on like the procedure section only of the code, because right now we've only seen like the behavioral violations part. The procedures part we're going to get sometime this week from University Council, or April 11th, which would just us be working, looking at all the public comments. So I'm waiting back to make sure that every committee member has a preference on that before I have a finalization, because it is a lot of work and, you know, people put in a lot of hours. Our meetings are Fridays from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m., which is such a fun spot to do this work in the morning on a Friday. So feel free to stop by. We have great breakfast foods, but also people are really, wow, a Friday morning meeting. That's a concept that I've never had to deal with before in my time here. But, you know, that is that. So that's the calendar. If people have questions, let me know. Stop me. Or
let me just ask the group. If we get on the 24th and have a special meeting on the 28th and vote on the 5th, is that going to work for people? If so, we can announce the 28th now. That's still good to me, actually. So I want to make sure people think it's a good idea. Richard?
Will the text be available to us before the...
Yeah, I'm sending it to you, to the UA, April 24th for the meeting of April 28th, if we have that. But as we get sections like fully done, you'll see those sections before. So like, for example, we'll have one section on like responsible speech and expression probably finalized, hopefully by this Friday's meeting. And once the CJC finalizes that, we'll give it to you all as soon as possible so you can start looking at it. It's a really short document. It's like only 2 pages. And so like you all can see that. So as we finish sections, you'll all will have those copies. Obviously, like, public comment does muddy that because like we have to present that in public comment. So you're like the first eyes of official public comment, but that public comment also might inform changes to that document as well.
So we could spend some time in our March and April meeting discussing it as well.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if there's no objection, let's say we will have a special meeting on April 28th, which is also Tuesday, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 4:30 to 6. Gina, can you make sure the room's available? Or is that available?
Tentatively scheduled it.
Okay, thank you.
In hopeful anticipation.
Okay, great, thank you.
The other document that I sent out, which is a great thing to just start priming and thinking about these key questions and themes, it's not the exact language, but it's stuff that are big changes to the code, like the big, I call them the key questions and themes of the stuff that we're really looking at. A lot of it we've already talked about, and I think there's pretty broad, like some of them there's broad agreement with the committee, in the committee that we're doing it, that we're going to support, you know, something like this, but we also want to socialize it amongst the UA itself because some of the questions and themes are big. So there's 7 of them currently. The first is narrowing the focus down to the student code of conduct only, so really applying to students, big one, obviously. The second is an organizational structure change, so we'll move the Office of Judicial Administrator under the Division of Student and Campus Life, specifically the Office of the Dean of Students, so the JA would report to the Dean of Students, who reports to the Vice President of Student and Campus Life. There would also be a subsequent name change to that. It would no longer refer to Office of Judicial Administrator, it would be the Office of Student Codes, like advisor or something like that. So it's more, so the name really invokes the student aspect of it. The third one is a standard of proof question and a burden of proof, however you want to refer to it as. Currently, the code of conduct has it at clear and convincing, which puts it out of line with our Title IX and our Greek life, which use preponderance of the evidence. This is really important to consider on twofold. One, the committee is very supportive and University Counsel's office is supportive of moving Greek life under the code, under a student code of conduct. And in order to make sure that Greek life is still understanding the same behaviors, there needs to be a conversation around, you know, if you want Greek life to be more accountable and more safe, preponderance is actually a better standard to use than clear and convincing. The other aspect to use is with the Trump regulations around Title IX, it's not actually giving you a, the guidance is not saying you must pick clear, convincing, or preponderance of the evidence. The guidance is most likely going to say, most likely, because it hasn't been officially dropped, to be in line with the, your other campus judicial proceedings. So if we choose to go to clear and convincing in the student code of conduct, there would be impetus to move Title IX and Policy 6.4 up to clear and convincing as well. If we keep the student code at preponderance of the evidence, our Title IX policy 6.4 would stay at the preponderance level, which then throws a wrench into this. So you have to think, you know, I have a personal opinion. That personal opinion is not as big of a deal because I'm the chair at this time. But I know there are some members of the committee who feel very, very strongly moving it to a preponderance, which would be a change in the code to keep Greek life and policy 6.4 in line. The fourth key theme is a separate free speech section. The code at this current part has a large section on Cornell's commitment to free speech and expression. And the president said, we're just going to carve it out entirely into a separate document because of another Trump regulation of free speech on college campuses. The university feels as though it is the best decision to have a very clear, concise document that denotes where we stand on freedom of speech and expression, which the committee is extremely supportive of because then it doesn't have to be like this, like, scattered thing within the code and really keep the code organized and focused and clear to students. The fifth part, Greek life under the code, we mentioned it and it's in the concept of the burden of proof. You know, we're the committee, the committee in the fall was very supportive and did vote to include recognized student organizations, Greek life in the code, in the student code of conduct, but understanding that has a burden of proof implication. The sixth question is a jurisdictional question. We always go back and forth on how far does the code like go off campus for and how does that process get done. It's very tricky, you know, largely it does apply to off campus when the behavior is serious enough, when the behavior, like the JA has a litany of five, that's still being debated, but, you know, understanding kind of what implication does that have, you know, especially in the Greek life context because of satellite chapter houses or annexes, how you might call them. So, you know, if it's an annex of one fraternity and all the guys are drinking in that fraternity, it's just underage drinking. Is that serious enough behavior to make it organizational or is that just all individual behavior? But if it's hazing in an off-campus location, that would be serious behavior. So that's kind of how I describe it. The weeds of that are still being worked out in the committee. And then the last one, it would be a pretty large change in how procedurally the code works. It's a move to what, you know, I call a single investigator model. It has a different denotations everywhere else, but a single investigator model is essentially when a case comes to the office, an investigator would go out and fact find, would kind of gather as much evidence as possible, and then present a report that doesn't recommend anything to the judicial administrator, and the judicial administrator would make the decision what violations those might be. As it currently stands, the JA and the assistant JAs go out and fact find. So this separates the fact finding from the adjudication of the code aspect. That's what is currently used. It will mirror very, very similarly the Title IX Policy 6.4 procedures and also the Greek life procedures. So again, the code is the odd one out of our two big judicial ones. So this is kind of squaring all of this together in a sense. So that's like our big seven themes as it stands currently. I wanted just to put those on the table so everyone has a thought of like what's happening, where the committee might be at. If you have questions, you know, the committee has its public minutes. Well, you all have access to the box by nature of the university assembly box. But as this stuff comes up, like I'll let you all know, like, here's the decision we kind of made with this area of the code, and here's the decision we haven't made. And if you have thoughts about this stuff, please let us know sooner rather than later so we can address your concerns or not address your concerns at the CJC level, because it would be kind of a nuisance for us to come up to the UA. It's like, here's what the CJC says. And it's like, well, my thought process wasn't involved in this. No, here it is. This is me officially inviting you. Please give me your thoughts, your comments, everything as possible. I want you to be involved so it's not a painful end of the semester for me. Yeah. I want to graduate peacefully.
We don't want that.
Thank you.
Would you like to graduate with a joke? I was just telling jokes. Would you like to hear my favorite joke?
Let's do it.
Why can't lobsters share?
Why?
Because they're shellfish.
Oh, with that, welcome to the IQ, the floor is yours.
Okay, I only have a few, and it's a small group, so I'll plenty of time, because I want to give you just three quick updates. One is on what we were calling novel coronavirus, and we now call COVID-19. I think everybody knows we had two students who were what are called persons under investigation. That just means people who meet the CDC criteria. So they had been in China, and they had sufficiently high fevers that we had to isolate them and test them. They both tested negative. And so far, there have been no positive cases in New York State. I think everybody sort of expects that over time, whether it's this spring or next fall, it seems likely that this virus will be making rounds. So I just want to make sure that everybody knows that we are in regular contact with our local public health officials. They're in regular contact with the CDC. We're following all the CDC and World Health Organization guidelines on screening and response. We do actually have a plan that was created back when the avian flu was going around in 2014-ish, it was before I got here. We've dusted that off, it's in pretty good shape. But much more importantly for right now, we are in the midst of a really bad flu season. There are dozens of people on campus every week, dozens who are testing positive for flu. So if you haven't had a flu shot, go get one. For students, they're free at Cornell Health Professionals. I don't know if they're free or not, but get one and they're free, okay. Wash your hands frequently. And I think things have gotten a little better, but I want to remind people to treat everyone kindly. And in particular, if you have friends who have family home in China and are very worried about them, go out of your way to interact with them and be nice to them. And they're very worried about their family back at home. Second thing, I know, I suspect this is what Joe was just talking about. So I'll be very, very brief on the code revision. I want to thank Logan and the CJC for all the work they did in the fall. I want to thank Joe very much for stepping up. As I've said here before, this has been a major concern since I got to Cornell. It's something people have talked to me about since the day I walked in the door. The students, every time I go to SA, someone asks me, where is the code? And I explain the process. We don't need to rehash the past. We know what happened last year. The only reason I mention it is I really had to convince the board to give us all another year. They want to see this as well. It's a risk. I met with CJC. I thought it was, you guys can weigh in, it was a very productive meeting. And what we agreed was that general counsel would take the work that had already been done, would produce three documents. The first, which I want to mention, in case you had mentioned it, the free speech document, which is campus-wide, and then the prohibited behavior, or like the expected behavior, where she tried to edit what was there. And then those have been given to CJC, and then the processes for adjudication. I saw a draft of it this morning. Kelly, my chief of staff, who's trained as an attorney, also is looking at it. And it will be out hopefully tomorrow. It might be Thursday before she gets it to you. We do have to meet the deadline for the end of the semester. It's gonna be tough, but I'm optimistic we can get there. Did you talk about the new regs from the federal government? Okay, so you know about that. It's really important. Really, it's what's coming out of the federal government is frankly scary. It's really, really scary. And so we need to make sure, if we only cared about risk, we would just not have a free speech statement, because then the feds can't come in and tell us we're not in compliance with our own free speech statement. But of course we're not going to do that. That would be insane. We need a strong free speech statement. We need one that applies to the whole university. But we need one that's clean and succinct and doesn't leave places where the feds can come in and sort of get in our business. And heaven knows they've been getting in the business of universities
various ways.
The building's on here. The last thing I want to mention, and I see Carolyn is here, and I don't know if you've talked yet about the sustainability resolution, not yet. Okay, so let me, and those of you who are at Faculty Senate, I'm just going to kind of repeat what I said there. I said the same thing to GPSA. I want to give you a sense of the university, where the university sees itself in the sustainability sense broadly. So I'll get to divestment, but I do first want to talk about two other areas real briefly. One is, I am actually very proud of what we're doing in teaching and research and engagement. You know, developing sustainable solutions to world problems requires really multidisciplinary perspectives, and that's something we're very good at. We have a lot of breadth. We can bring a world-class agriculture school and a world-class vet school along with science departments and economics departments. And I think humanities. I think the humanities matter in telling the story. I always tell people to go read Jessamyn Ward's book, Salvage the Bones. Salvage the Bones? If you really want to understand climate change. Atkinson Center has 558 faculty fellows, and they not only teach and do research, but they're also engaged out there in the world. Bob, for example, on the council of 22 people who have been appointed by the state of New York to sort of make real their plan to get to carbon neutrality. So I think that there's a lot going on in teaching, research, and engagement. I also think there's a lot going on in campus operations. We're not perfect, but there's a whole lot going on. And remember, I was talking actually to the president of Dartmouth earlier today. And like Dartmouth, we're in a cold, dark place. It's a lot harder to do what we're trying to do than if we were at Stanford. The first energy conservation initiative for Cornell was put out in 1985. In 2001, we were the first university to sign the Kyoto Protocol. And we've really been emphasizing and investing significantly in sustainable operations since then, and in particular since David Skorton, when he was president, announced our goal of carbon neutrality by 2035. I'm not going to go into a lot of the details. You can look at sustainability at cornell.edu. But it's everything from investing heavily in technologies that we know work, like solar, right? So we're running lots of solar farms, to trying to develop new technologies like the source heating, which if it works, will not only have a huge impact on this campus, but could have an impact in a lot of places. Bob is much more of an expert on this than me, but what my experts tell me is, when you think about earth source heating, it's not a matter of if it works or it doesn't work, it's gonna be the degree that we're gonna get something out of it. And the question is just how much, and can we then use heat pumps nearby to get the elevators on? But I'm not gonna say anymore, because Bob knows the science way more than I did.
Good song.
Thank you. You and Lance have been good to your sons. The third topic, of course, is our investments, and that's what you'll be talking about later. The students, and so everybody knows how the endowment works and what an endowment, you've seen the FAQ that we put out on that. I do think it is really important to remind everyone that the board, like boards across the country, has been very clear in saying that the principal purpose of the endowment is to provide income for the advancement of the important educational and mission-related objectives to which the university is dedicated. And the board members have a legal fiduciary responsibility to ensure that those goals are met, that the funds are put to the purposes for which they were donated. The endowment really can't be politicized. That said, as it is feasible to invest in ways that are consistent with our values, the investment committee tries to do that. So the board delegates its authority to the investment committee, which is a group of both current and former trustees. The investment committee sets the strategy, and then the investment office, some of you know Ken Miranda, the chief investment officer, he runs the investment office, and it's their job to carry out that strategy. It's a little bit like the board decides on the strategy for the university, and it's my job to carry that out. If you look at what's been going on with the endowment over the past, particularly the past 4 or 5 years, particularly since Ken Miranda got in place, the number of funds, and actually the amount of the endowment overall, that's invested in what are called ESG funds, environmental, social, and government funds. These are funds where people try to invest for good causes. The number of those funds and the amount of money has grown significantly. So in December of 2015, 57.5% of our managers, so the investment office hires managers who do the investments. 7.5% of the managers. 57.5% of the money was being managed by managers who were either signatories, many of them to the UN, or UNPRI, United Nations Principles of Responsible Investing. Today, it's up to 70.8% of the funds. And there's another 7 or 8% that's like in cash for US treasuries. That isn't really, this doesn't make sense. It's just not relevant. So roughly 80% of our funds are already invested in that way. The board has a set of policies. The policies were put in place 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, the first time fossil fuel investment came up for considering divestment. They have both a set of processes, which involve resolutions coming to them, and then a set of standards. It is true that 4 years ago, 5 years ago, they said that climate change did not meet their standards, the particularly significant standards, one of moral reprehensibility. I cannot speak for the board. I can't tell you what the board is or is not going to do. What I can say is that I think in the past 4 or 5 years, both the investment landscape has changed. You see that in the growth of ESG investments. Science around climate change has changed. Public concern with climate change has changed. And although I cannot with I don't have the authority with certainty to say if the five resolutions come through, there will be a serious discussion. By the way, I can tell you with near certainty, I've engaged with many, many of the board members. In fact, we had a conversation in January on this. If the five resolutions come through, the board, I believe, very, very strongly believe, will in good faith engage with the issue and have a serious discussion. I think that is all I wanted to say. So I can take questions.
Great to hear. Questions?
Richard. Richard.
Hi, Martha. You said much of this at the Faculty Senate as well, so I couldn't hear it twice. When I heard it the first time, I had a question about one of the passages. If we do not divest in fossil fuels, you said at one point, if we divest, we lose our proxy vote. And I thought about this. And you know, you can invest for economic return, and at the same time, as you said, you can exercise your ownership proxy in the correct way. One of the things that struck me about this is, if we were as a university community, if we came to know exactly where the money was invested, in other words, we knew what the portfolio was, then we as a university community could recommend these actions. So the question I have, that's going to be a question. That's the second question. The first question is, does the university now, has it ever sponsored a proxy resolution on, say, fossil fuels? Has it ever, that's the first question. The second question is, you know, could we do this? Could we know what the portfolio is? So, set up a committee
So you got a lot of questions in there. So first of all, let me explain the proxy. You don't have to be able to warrant at the board, at the Faculty Senate. Someone asked me at the Faculty Senate, where do I stand? And what I said was, I actually think it's a really complicated question. And I gave this as an example of the complexity. Now, you might or you might not agree with it, but this is certainly one of the things that the board will be discussing. And that is this question of whether you lose the ability to influence companies when you completely disengage, right? So there is a sense, I disagree with it, but there is a sense amongst many people that when you have part ownership in the company and you're allowed to do proxy voting, you can influence that company. It's a little bit like the same argument we make about why are we still in China? There's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is we believe that we are influencing for the good. We are having a positive being there. When you disengage, you have no place. So that is one of the things that makes this complicated. Now, you know, this complication, there's layers on layers of complications. You might say, you know, well, like, you're a drop in the bucket. How much influence can you really have to a proxy vote? But of course, one could make that same argument out of the vestment. You're a drop in the bucket. So just as background, I was just giving this as an example of the kind of complexity that comes up. To answer your question, though, as I understand it, and I'm speaking secondhand, I'm going to have to ask Ken exactly your question, but as I understand it, the way in which we have been influencing proxy voting is by hiring managers who sign on to ESG. I mean, we have you know, gazillions of investments. And we don't invest directly. We have managers who are investing, and they're changing their investments every day. So what we do is we hire managers who have signed on and said, I'm going to vote proxies that are consistent with the UNPRI policies. As far as standing up yet another committee, I don't think the board is going to be open to that. The board very seriously believes in strong governance, and that's why they take seriously the 5 assemblies we already have. Other universities don't even have that level of governance. I can't. And you know, the investment office is moving very quickly. They move at a completely different speed than a faculty committee would. So I don't think, Richard, that suggestion is likely to get much traction. Just trying to be honest with you, as I always am here. I could tell you what you want to hear. But
other questions, comments? Logan.
Hey, Martha.
Hi, Logan.
So I emailed you and Kelly last night. I'm going to ask you a different version of
My answer is going to be I handed it off to the provost to look at. It's not
really okay. I'd like to at least get it on the record if that's all right.
Sure.
There have been some cases across Cornell, both undergrad and grad students not receiving their GI benefits with a huge delay. And these veteran students don't have loans. So they don't have money for rent and groceries, and they're either having to take out loans or borrow money and are really stressed out and are just trying to figure out what's causing the delay and how Cornell could best support them.
Yeah, so I did get that question late last night. It's actually in the purview of John Furtick, our Vice President for Enrollment Management. I handed it off to the provost to go to him. John said he had not heard this complaint, so someone should come to him and inform him.
Okay.
And you know, we certainly, and Mike Kotlikoff, the provost in particular, has really been pushing both to increase the number of veterans we have and to provide support for them, and he's been investing in that. So if they have specific suggestions, he's happy to look at them.
Oh,
I
so
don't have.
I'd love to be put in contact with him, or if I could just email him, because
yeah.
I'm co-president
yeah.
of the Law School Veterans Association.
Yeah. Email, you can either email the provost,
okay.
and you can also email John Burdick, who is the vice provost
okay.
for enrollment management.
But I do know that we have undergrads and graduate students right now that haven't received.
Okay, well, so they need to tell someone, because we
yeah.
didn't know.
Okay.
That.
Chris?
Hey, President Pollack.
Hi.
So, the CIC, the Campus Infrastructure Committee, has two major resolutions. One is the divestment resolution, which is sitting across all of the assemblies, I believe, and then the campus circulator resolution, which is sort of like an idea of on-campus only TCAT. One comment about the divestment. Thank you for being able to put out in the Chronicle the fossil fuel FAQ document. I will say that we really debated passionately about trying to address the board's criteria specifically, like how it all went, and we looked at what had happened. As the chair, I was like, we need to do a Cornell research paper on this, and it turned out that had already happened. But even in the FAQ, information like our holdings, our carbon 100 oil and gas, and carbon 100 coal is 1% and 0.3% respectively the total endowment. That kind of information was not really easily surfaceable, even when you try to look through all the information and go through the channels. So even having that public is a big help in the direction. And so we really made a concerted effort to, for the first time in 5 years, now that all of this new information is available, to really address and make an attempt to make the argument against the Board of Trustees criteria. And I think we've achieved that, and I'm proud that we are giving it a try, because we didn't want to just do the same thing again.
The white paper is very well written. Again, I can't speak for the board as we're at Lincoln, but I have been, in fact, I handed the white paper out to the board at their last meeting, because I said to them, wherever you end up, whether you agree or disagree, I think you should be proud that a group of Cornellians put this together. It's very well done.
And so switching topics, the campus circulator. So the idea is sort of on-campus only TCAT is really the idea. It's currently sitting in all of the assemblies except for the Faculty Senate, and we're hoping that any kind of comments, and we'll have an amended version to pass at the end of April. It's really sort of a project request. Like, here's this idea that has been around for 11 years, and now we're hoping that someone will actually do it, and it's on Bridget Brady's plan. It seems like funding is going to be a barrier in this project, specifically when we talk about, ironically, barrier-free transportation. So the idea that anybody on Cornell campus can get onto this system without having to swipe their card or pay a fee. And I was wondering, if the resolution does get passed, who would you suggest in the next step that we work with to discuss the funding issue?
Well, if the resolution gets passed, it will come to me. And I will be talking with my team about it. It is going to be very expensive, and we don't have unlimited funding. So if we do that, we're going to have to take away something else. That's, you know, if this is not an inexpensive project by any means. Of course, I think people would like to do it. The question is, what do we not do to come up with the funds for that?
Sure. So is there, did you just take that as a takeaway, or is there somebody that after?
So when this comes to my office, it will get this, when resolutions come to my office, unless they're a resolution like the student assembly has approved some money for a byline funding, and then it just goes sign up. Any significant resolution that comes to my office comes to cabinet, which is my senior team. So that includes my Kotlikoff, who's the provost, who's responsible for the budget, and Joanne DeStefano, who oversees facilities and actually a different aspect of the budget, and it will get discussed there. It will get taken seriously, but it's very expensive, and like, what would you like not to have happen for that to happen?
Sure, and so mostly I guess I would say is that we know that we're not done. This is just the very start, and there's committees across all the assemblies that have this in their constituents' interests. And so,
no, and we would like to be responsible. I don't mean to be negative,
sure.
But it's, you know, it's a little bit. So student assembly, for example, always, and I appreciate this one's more and more and more and more and more and all services. We want to provide that, but that's expensive. Something else has to go. So we will absolutely take it seriously. We will consider it real seriously. I don't know the details of it, so I can't really say more. We take seriously every single resolution. We take seriously 99% of the resolution. And I won't tell you which one.
All of the UA.
All of the UA ones.
Thank you.
Yes.
Real quick, I know that you know, the methodology laid out by the board with regards to investment has to do with if all five of the constituent assemblies pass, it goes directly to the board. I'm just curious, will you or your office be drafting any type of statement, or be looking at it in tandem or before it goes to the board, or will you just, you know, let the board make their determination?
So here's the process. As I understand it, all five of the assemblies will have voted before the next board meeting.
That's our plan.
assuming that's true, what has to happen is there's an investment committee meeting, mm-hmm. then it goes to an executive committee meeting, and then it goes to a full board discussion. Typically in March, there is not an executive committee meeting, there's an investment committee. Depending on how that goes, we may be able to quickly pull together an executive committee meeting. I do want a level set. I would not be entirely surprised if the board discussed it in March and didn't want to make a final decision until May. I don't know, again, I don't know what they're doing, but I don't think anyone should, if that happens, that anyone should interpret that as anything more than this is a really serious precedent-setting decision, and they want to take it seriously. I talk to the board chair every week, so and Joanne DeStefano, our CFO, and the EVP talks to the chair of the investment committee. So there's conversation. It's not as if, in fact, the board chair and I together set the agenda, so it's not as if, you know, they're going to show up and not going to have anything to say. Yes, Joe, hi.
Hi. So it's kind of two questions in one, but all relating to like equity in the admissions processes at Cornell. So first being, what has Cornell, obviously the UC system put out their report about going test optional for the ACT, yeah. SAT and admissions. Would Cornell be thinking of doing something similar, of putting together a study group to see how it would affect our admissions? And then the second, Johns Hopkins recently dropped legacy admissions as a consideration. Is that also something that the university would consider studying?
So I can't tell you the details yet because I haven't yet gone to the board, but I am in the process of putting together a major initiative on affordability and access. So that's number one. Specifically with respect to your two questions, although the UC system agreed to drop those tests, there's actually pretty serious debate amongst educational experts about whether in fact that will lead to more diversity or whether it will have the exact opposite effect. We have a brand new, and we started in fairly new, within the last few months, brand new, we never had this position before, Vice President of Enrollment Management. He is really smart. You see him quoted all the time. He's really deeply concerned with equity issues. So I would want first to defer to him on that. On the legacy issue, I thought a lot, even more than I know, about the same as I have about divestment, about the legacy issue. I very much, very, very much want to increase our socioeconomic diversity. We're lagging. There's just no question. We are not living up to Ezra Cornell's vision for this university. And that, I hope, assuming the board approves it, will be part of what we put out. I actually believe that it is not inconsistent that you can both have some sort of consideration about family ties, and in a very intentional and dramatic way, increase socioeconomic diversity. That is, I believe, first of all, it is just false that all of the students who come with family ties are wealthy white students. That's just not true. Secondly, if at the end of the day, what giving attention to family ties, as we do for athletics, as we do for first generation, as we do for all kinds of, if that means that a student whose family comes from Cornell ends up at Cornell, as opposed to a student whose family comes from Yale and they end up here, I'm fine with that. And the reason I'm fine with that, and I wasn't always fine with that, but I go out on the road a lot and I meet Cornell alumni all the time, not all wealthy. And the passion that they have for this university and the community that they build for other Cornellians coming out is really quite impressive. If I thought that keeping a concern with family ties, I hate but if I thought that keeping a concern of family ties would be at odds with increasing our socioeconomic diversity, I'd be out there marching to get rid of it. I don't think it does. Now, the proof, it's up to me to prove that. Mm-hmm. But that's my point.
Hi, President Pollack.
GPSA, by the way, already passed that resolution. I'm just saying.
So we are currently on the search for a new dean of the graduate school. For you, what would be a determining factor in an ideal candidate?
Well, first of all, let me say it's the provost's job to hire that.
Right.
So I'm always looking for a few things in deans. The first thing is something I'm looking for in any person I hire for any position, and that's personal integrity. Because my view is that everything is based on trust, and if I trust you and you trust me, even if we really disagree, we can make progress. But the opposite is true too. If we don't trust each other, I don't care how much we agree, nothing works. So they have to have personal integrity. Secondly, they have to be of an academic stature that they are both respected by the faculty and the students. And they really understand, you know, they've been a graduate student, they've been either a professional or it's a graduate school, a PhD student, and they understand what you're going through. And then thirdly, I think that at this moment, we need someone who really understands the changing landscape for PhD students. My field, computer science, has always been a field where the large majority of PhDs do not become professors. It was always the case that 80-85%, you went to Google, you went to Facebook, well, in my age, you went to IBM, you went to Microsoft, and those are prestigious jobs. And we understood that. We faculty understood that, and we mentored it. But that's not true of most fields, and it's starting to change. And so we need someone who wants to. That's what I would say.
Another time for another question?
Yeah. Kind of in relation to that, I think it's tying into what you're just saying about this academic, the change in terms of students, mm-hmm. graduate students, and where they're probably going after the time at Cornell, right? Mm-hmm. Do you envision increasing resources through the grad school or other means in terms of career services?
Yeah. Again, I think this is a little bit on a much smaller scale. This is like the circulator question.
Right.
If this is of great interest, then when the provost does the budget, he can consider allocating more resources there. But we, everybody always wants more of everything, and you always have to be weighing what are the alternatives. We have been investing. I mean, we invested in the BEST program. Yeah. We've grown some people who are helping in the international program. If there's a need for more, sure, we're certainly going to try to do it. But I can't just say here, yes, we will do it, because we always have to look. I mean, it's a little bit like anybody's home budget, right? You got to look at the full mix of things that you want to do, and then you have to prioritize. Okay.
Thank you for
coming.
Thank
you all.
We appreciate it.
Stay warm.
Right on time, exactly. Let's go back to the regular agenda, which will take us to M.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to just mention for the record that I think that now that Carolyn is the faculty representative, that she should be referenced as the primary sponsor, and me as the co-sponsor, because this is really born out of her incredible work, both in terms of the text of the resolution and the white paper, which I've been sitting around to everybody that can, because it makes incredibly compelling arguments with regards to the criteria that was set up by the board. I am just going to say just a few brief things, because I think questions in college should take most of the floor time. Just with regards to a few things that were mentioned both in the FAQ and by President Pollack, and I really appreciate the sensitivity and the efforts that have gone that this university has undertaken to achieve carbon neutrality institutionally and structurally. I believe that should be viewed in parallel, not in parallel to divestment, not necessarily in lieu of it. I think that our investments portfolio is a statement of our values, and the core values, which also recently just came out with the university, are in my opinion, putting in conflict with any investments in fossil fuels, at least, or in mainly fossil fuels. So I think that there is, many other institutions have divested without violating their responsibilities to pursue a profitable return on investment and supports the mission of the endowment. I'm not really moved by the argument that the purpose of the endowment means that only that total control and only a certain pathway to profit is expected. There is plenty of flexibility in the methodology by which an endowment can pursue profit, and that flexibility can be in line with the values of the institution that the endowment supports. Again, with regards to proxy voting, I'm not going to call that there is any evidence that has ever been utilized to great effect, especially to motivate these companies or anyone to pursue a path of a fossil-free future or addressing the climate crisis. So those are just a few comments. Again, this is really your great work, Dylan, so I'd be happy to take questions, but I'll turn it over to you.
Plan to say anything, but on the proxy voting, because Martha raised it at the Faculty Senate, I did a little looking myself, and it turns out that 125 requests were made by shareholders to the fossil fuel industry between 1992 and 2014, just to investigate the impact of fossil fuels on the environment, and all were dismissed or rejected out of hand. Like, there was never even a serious discussion of them. So that suggests that something like, how important is proxy voting if that kind of data is available to us. And I sent that in an email to Martha, and she then, between the Faculty Senate meeting and this meeting, didn't bring up proxy voting. You brought it up, Richard, so that's interesting. So research moves the conversation forward. But I also want to say, I learned from Adam, I think, and Bob, the most, I think, potentially the most effective argument in the white paper, which is what is called the first mover advantage, which is if Cornell is the first Ivy League to divest, that'll have huge headlines, it'll bring us all kinds of attention, you know, then the other Ivies will probably follow, you know, at some slower pace, and everybody will be like, yeah, but Cornell was the first, and I think the trustees might like that, they might like to claim that, and, you know, be Harvard is our main goal, so.
Richard. So, Adam, I liked your introduction to this, and I like the resolution. I do think there's more than one way to proceed in this. Martha did not really respond to the proxy question I made. Proxies have been used for a long time. The Vietnam War, Catholic convents, seminaries, used to put one stock of Dao and then put forward a resolution on napalm. Such resolutions, proxy resolutions, they don't do anything to the investment profile in the portfolio. They don't interfere with it at all. They are statements of moral, ethical standing. Kind of opinion, but it's rights, things to do. We have a lot of those right now. You know, the Uyghurs, computer sciences, or computer companies are involved in repression. Johnson & Johnson has arsenic and baby powder. There's the opiates. I mean, we could go through this. And you wouldn't take out, or I'm sure the trustees would never agree to take out all of those companies, you wouldn't have anything left in your portfolio. But what you can do is Cornell could say, because they're in the portfolio, could say, sponsor resolutions calling attention to those things. The way to do that is first we have to know what's in that portfolio. Then once we know what's in that portfolio, then we could ask pressure for these kinds of statements. So I think the first step, I mean, this is, and then you tell me, you're the sponsors, tell me what you think. But I would add a section to this amendment, to this resolution amendment, that Cornell make public the individual items in the investment portfolio. That's the first step towards calling for responsibility. This is a different tack than divestment. Divestment would still be there, but it would be one that says for all these other issues, we would use the portfolio and use Cornell to make it a stand, an ethical stand. So if you're in agreement, I would offer that amendment.
Let me just interject, if I may. I don't disagree with what you say. It would be great to know. My sense is, from having talked to some of the trustees over the years, that they're actually more likely to divest than they are to divulge. That would be my
right.
Secondly, their guidelines say that if all five assemblies pass the same resolution, they will undertake it.
But two responses. The first one is Martha said that she has said the resolutions do not have to be the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the response to the second.
But that's not what the trustees have said.
The trustees are, look, they can be really anal and say that they're not exactly the same. But this is a separable amendment. So the first part would be the same in all the assemblies. The second part, this has another dimension to it. It doesn't imperil. You may be very right about the divulge. You know, the divulge as opposed to the divestment.
Of course, we'll never know what they divest if they don't divulge. So we just, it's a little bit of a moot question. But I feel really strongly about this. I mean, you two are in charge of the resolution, so if it's not a friendly resolution, I won't do it. But I feel very strongly about this. I mean, this is a public matter. You know, if this, and Adam said it very eloquently, if the portfolio is an ethical set of commitments, you should know what they want.
Adam?
If I can offer two responses, I'm not against a transparency resolution of some kind. In my mind, I feel like that's a separate resolution. I mean, I see where you say that it ties to this particular effort because transparency equals accountability, which makes complete sense. But as it was pointed out, it could be two big asks instead of one for one. And for two, it just feels like that it, correct me if I'm wrong, my impression of our intent with the resolution is to at least try to provide the board with deference and latitude to at least divest in a manner that they can say they see fit. Another thing that I was going to bring up in the employee assembly is that there might be employees that will say, well, why can't we put employee-specific clauses into our version? And I'm planning on offering something along the lines of a letter that's an addendum along with the resolution. Obviously, that doesn't require anybody to respond to it, but it at least makes a statement that adds those things while keeping the text of the resolution the same. So I'm okay with a different resolution at a different time asking for that or some sort of addendum. That's just my opinion. Again, I don't want to speak for both of us, but.
No, I really agree. I think our goal all along has been a strategic kind of laser focused goal so that at the GPSA, for example, we actually talked about whether we should, the delegate said, you know, is it better for us not to offer any amendments or suggestions? And we decided it was. It's just better to leave it as clean and forceful as possible around this issue. All the other things are important too, and I am completely in agreement about transparency, but I think it's a bigger lift. And I think fossil fuels, my own reason for pouring as much energy into this single resolution, even though I entirely agree that, you know, arsenic and baby food is entirely unacceptable, for example, and that we should not be investing in a lot of these corporations that are doing terrible and unjust things, is that fossil fuels are just in a different category from all the others, that they're bringing the devastation of all of the human civilization, including the whole university, to a halt soon. And so we need to make as strong a statement as we can, as soon, as urgently as possible. So I would say let's move on that next as a separate question, and I get the urgency. I kind of wish we could treat this like an ordinary political issue, but it doesn't feel like one to me. It feels like one that should just go ahead completely cluttered with any other criterion.
Other questions?
So I don't know if it's possible, Richard. This is the thing. Let me make an analogy. Let's take like the LEED certification of a building. Okay, so there's a group that has trust, and if they certify you gold or platinum, it means, you know, I think it means something. When you build a building, you don't say this is the CO2 footprint, this is the methane footprint. It doesn't get down to that level. So in the financial side, you have this ESG. I don't fully understand it, but it's a way of certifying funds. It's a way of certifying financial managers and so on. I would like to see, I'd like to have trust in that agency, just as I kind of have trust in the LEED thing, and to find out what is the reputation of that. If you hear Miranda talk, which I did, it looks pretty good in terms of our commitment to ESG funds and whatever, that we are holding up to that. I'd like to learn more about that before I get down to seeing the lineup of here are all the stocks and how much we have in each one. I would rather, I don't know enough to know if that's possible, quite honestly, because remember, Miranda's office is a manager of managers, okay? So anyway, in terms of quantifying progress towards divestment, I'd like to see more homework done about how investment funds are rated by reliable sources in terms of whether they're moving us towards right end.
Yeah, so but it's certainly possible. Big funds do this all the time. Talk a little bit about TIAA crap. I mean, they do this instantaneously. So this, to go through the information, they could, there's probably 20 minutes. But that isn't really the issue. The issue is, and I hear it, if Adam and Carolyn see this politically as a separate issue, and it would muddy the waters. I don't see it as a separate issue, because I think if you're going to know whether the best, somebody says they're divesting and you can't look, you don't know. So I don't see it as a separate issue at all. But that said, and I don't want to muddy the waters. I do want it on the table for the future. Mm-hmm. I do want it to be something that we understand or we might consider in the future, that regardless of how it's invested, we use those investments as a platform for proxies, for resolutions of ethical and moral statements. Get it on the table, that satisfies me. Bob's right, they're not gonna do it. We say we don't wanna do it, they're not gonna do it. But sometimes you do things even though you know the other person's not gonna do it. But it's premature in this case, so I withdraw the
agreement. I agree with you, it should be on the table. Mm-hmm. And I also do believe in asking or demanding sometimes things, even if you know they're gonna happen. Time for doing that. But in this case, I actually think there's a reasonable chance that the trustees will divest. And I don't want to distract them from that, because that'd be such a statement if they do. And the less reason we give them to not stick with our focus, the better, right?
Adam. I just want to, about to make a motion, we'll see if we have anything to say. I just want to make one thing I forgot to mention a little bit ago. And I'm not slamming anything like that. She's under an enormous amount of pressure with regards to the issue, I imagine. I just want to say that I don't believe or see this as politicizing the endowment, that statement was made. And more dropping a book is politicizing gravity. I think this is science. We're an institution of learning and science. And this is a statement that we should not be investing things that we know have a detrimental effect. So I just want to get that on the record. And with that, I move previous question.
Second.
Okay. I guess we'll take a vote then. All those in favor of the resolution, raise your flag. Opposed? Abstain? The resolution is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you all. I take it back to you, Joe.
Yes. So those were my key themes, my dates. You all have those documents. I can take initial questions. I mean, the CJC has met twice, once with Logan chairing, once with me chairing this semester. I can take initial questions, initial comments, concerns about the code and things that you think we should take a look at. I want to coordinate with the EA on the employee specific date. Mary just emailed me while we were here. She's like, totally, here's the one I can't do, coordinate with the EA too. So we'll have it sponsored by y'all as well. That'd be wonderful. Yeah, any questions, comments, concerns for me that I can communicate with the committee? I'd love to come away with any initial thoughts to the key themes people might have. Yeah.
So I'd like to recognize the CJC members, knowing that they are volunteers and have put in a Herculean effort, all of them from all the different constituencies, and I feel like they've done an excellent job of representing us. I've also recognized the chair and the former chair of the CJC for the peaceful transition of power and the fact that we've been able to get a timeline with these things. Speaking about something which I'll email you specifically, Joe, when I read through the code, the term judicial administrator, which you had mentioned is possibly going to change in title, is mentioned in section 3 underneath the scope, and that's the first time it's mentioned in the document. Right above section 3 is section 2 where there is terminology, and it seems like there's an opportunity to whatever that name is to be explained that this is what this person is, even though, and then what they will do to possibly help you later on. Because I was just surprised where it was like, oh, this is, you know, what the scope is, and then this person just shows up. So I was surprised that I knew what that meant. But if I was a student trying to read and it was like, is this person a good guy or a bad guy or who are they? I would need to know a little bit more. So I'll make sure I send that in an email to you. And then there was, I had an interesting language point of view where in 2.4, so this is like really probably a committee level thing, but just to say that I actually did read it and pay attention. When we get to the prohibited conducts part, one of the prohibitive conducts is line 2.4, compliance with the enforcement of the code, which I felt was a funny way. That seems like that shouldn't be prohibited conduct to comply with the enforcement of the code, and maybe it's a linguistic thing. And so maybe some of our English professors could help us with that. But when it says 2.4, compliance with the enforcement of the code, failure to comply with, and then it says these things, which to me was sort of like confusing of, if I comply, I'm in violation. So it's probably just a syntax thing from just like an employee totally reading this code. So I'll send those points to you in email. Maybe that will help, but I was really happy with the draft that we have, as well as the annotations of some CJC members think this, JACC thinks that, and that helped me really weigh what perspectives are out there. And really looking at this and how much of an effort it must have been because of legalese that had been in there. Like it still, I had to like really put my brain on to read it, which wasn't really bad, but I could just tell how far it has come from before where it just looked like hieroglyphics to now it's in English enough where I was just like, oh, I got to take one more English class to get this. So thank you guys for your work.
Yeah. And I would say definitely on the terminology, like JA, where it gets defined, some parts will show up in like the violation section. So most likely the JA's office will be defined in the procedure adjudication section. So it is, while they're one document, it really feels like two documents that we're working with, because one is really the logistics and stuff, and the other is really the, okay, if I'm a student, what do I need to know stuff? Like most students don't need to know, here's the process for me until like they get to that point, if they ever get to that point. So I think that's a huge thing. The other thing I did not mention in key themes and stuff like that, we're gonna be pulling out the appointment of the JCC UHRB stuff from the code and create separate documents for those. That stuff does not belong in a code of conduct. It belongs in HR policies and practices. It can be housed amongst the UA as like the steward of the document, but that stuff is ridiculous. And also to put them in line with other things. So Office of Complainants Advisors, they don't have the same vetting process as the JCCs do. The JCCs go through way more of a vetting process, and that just doesn't feel fair from a JCC's perspective. So we're also going to be taking a look at that stuff to make sure that it's more streamlined, it's simplified, make sure the UHRB stuff is more streamlined and simplified, and making sure that, you know, it's not like page 68 of your 100 and something page code or something like that.
Yes,
go ahead. I just have a question.
Yeah.
And I'm new to this discussion, so it sounds really important and valuable, mm-hmm. and thank you. The preponderance of evidence versus mm-hmm. the clear, I didn't yeah. understand that.
Yeah.
Could you just give me a quick lesson?
So preponderance of the evidence is kind of like 51%, more likely than not it happened,
I
where
see.
Clear convincing is like, we are like very strongly, gotcha. Like we know it happened,
gotcha.
Kind of thing. So one's lower, one's higher.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for asking. I didn't know. I guess. But let me tell you something that's related to this, and that is that the term of the judicial administrator runs up in June. And the university assembly botched up many things last year, one of which was the reappointment of the judicial administrator. So it actually was not done appropriately at all. It's done on sort of an ad hoc basis. What's supposed to happen is that I, as chair of the UA, are supposed to have a convene a search going into the reappointment process. And of course, I haven't done that, and it doesn't necessarily make sense if we're redefining the position either. So, Martha Pollock and I've talked about it briefly, and she's asked me to work with Kelly and the Dean of Students Office to come up with some sort of an interim solution. We may, just to let you know, have some sort of a interim person doing whatever until the code is finalized and we figure out how to make it work right in the long term. I don't think it'll involve the entire UA formally, but I want you to be aware that those conversations are going on. Richard?
Yeah, so I was just on the committee to do the search a year ago last fall. And we did come up with a recommendation, and then the administration failed to act on it.
Yeah.
So it was a complicated thing. Michelle continued in that thing. But one thing that struck us, though, when we were doing this in the committee, there are, I think it's every work day or something like that, at Cornell, there are something like two or three cases. You can't have an interim, I mean, you can't do it well and have an interim administrator.
I understand that.
It is a recipe for...
That's one of the reasons that Martha and the trustees want us to get this done as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, we are in a difficult situation.
Yeah, it is. The workload is incredible.
Yep.
And caseload, I should say. It is a workload, but the caseload is incredible. And it really needs that, you know. Yeah.
No, I hear you, Tilly.
The one thing that concerns me is back earlier this academic year, I asked Martha if we could just amend the current bylaws and change that position so that we didn't run into this problem. And I just want to echo with Richard, I feel like having an interim person while we try to figure this out and like some sort of random search committee that's not going to be in line with what the CJC brings forward is problematic. So I'm just not sure why we didn't amend the current bylaws, because I saw this as a problem back in September. So it's just kind of frustrating that we're ending up in this position.
No, it's very frustrating, but the fact is we didn't amend them, and so we are where we are. And we either do a formal search and hire someone, or we are going to do something ad hoc. And there's no other choice, really.
Yeah, I would say it's not a concern from our end if it's interim or however it works. We don't care as the CJC how things look in the terms, the code, whether or not we think the volume is it. The actual adjudication processes and violations that we're doing are going to be so simplified compared to what we are that I think it would, if there is concern about who sits in that position, I think actually the job becomes much easier with a better code just because we're making it. I mean, it doesn't need to be, you know, kind of the mess that it is currently. I mean, the violations look much more clear cut. They're much more prominent. They're easier to read. So, you know, whoever sits in that role, I don't know the back end stuff of it all, but, you know, I think the code itself will be easier to adjudicate from any standpoint. So that.
It's still going to be a messy transition. It's inevitable.
The new thing.
So one thing to think about, this is a separable part of the code. The implications aren't really great for any other part. It's a reporting. And
we could consider that separately and rapidly, apart from the rest of the code, so that we would then have a warrant to do a search and get this moved. Joe, I don't have that confidence in you that even a simple code is going to make that work, that caseload easy. I think it's going to be troublesome, but it is a way of, but if we could move forward just on that section of the code, it might be a way to make this transition easier.
Yeah, full transparency, that's not high on our priority list to make a change with it first. I mean, you know, changing the procedures of how we appoint people is definitely not more important. Like, violations are the most important, readability of the code is most important, then the processes of adjudicating the code, and then the actual reappointment. Like, the bylaw, like, that's, like, way at the tail end of things. Like, that's not something that I would prioritize in our decision-making tree, just because I don't think, like, that's where the president's office kind of sees the prioritization. And I think right now it's all a game of prioritization. And, you know, devoting time to, like, we don't have that from university council's office. That's the stuff that comes in the processes that we're going to get in this week, but we're still working on last week's stuff. So we're going to, you know, chip away at last week's stuff, try to get that as done as possible. When the processes come up. And again, anything that we change in the code is subject to public comment. So while it would be great to get that stuff done, get this stuff done, we have to vet it through public comment. That is what the code says currently. We have to do that. That is our duty as the CJC. So really, we wouldn't be seeing this stuff for final votes until post April 11th, after the CJC has reviewed everything with public comment again. So timing is really difficult, but timing is kind of, we have to just work to the deadlines that we have kind of laid out. Like, I understand the concern of, like, having personnel be in the right places, but, you know, some of this is kind of stuff that should have been done years ago. Here we are. But I'm optimistic that we're going to get it done. So, like, I'm very, very optimistic that we're going to get it done. Like, it feels like everyone's on a pedal to the, whatever phrase, I don't ever do them phrases right, but we're gonna get it done.
To the metal,
I guess. I don't drive cars.
One question, Joe. I know before you had your staff correctly, people are showing up, you've got quorum.
Yep.
You had feedback from everyone to attend.
Yeah, everyone is showing. We had a resignation from the graduates. James resigned.
Oh, today?
Today.
So if we could get that,
yeah,
that would be one.
We're going to try it by the next few days.
Okay, perfect. The meeting times are 9 to 10:30. It's hard for me to change out of those. Like,
on Fridays, right?
Okay, yeah, on Fridays, yeah. Like, the poll that we had out, that thing was disgusting to look at. Like, I looked at it after everyone was there. I was like, oh no, there's no good time. So that's the time, and unfortunately that's the time we have to kind of stick to. So if you're thinking of appointments, keep that in mind. Thank you.
We're way ahead of schedule. So, well, we've accomplished a lot. So I don't have any problem. Logan.
Wait, just real quick, did was that resignation only to the CJC or to
no?
The
it was also to the
UA.
To UA.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that, so we have an open space right now for a graduate.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. We have a couple of names, right? We're down to 17.
We have one
get a veteran.
Yeah, one to fill.
I'm gonna write to the Cornell Law veterans and see if we could try to get a veteran grad student and see some veterans represented.
Yeah, I'd say if they also could, if they also are interested in being involved with UC, that is two groups of but if not, that's fine. We're working.
I'll see what I can do.
A quick question. This is just because I have to set the leadership meeting for the EA. It's a bit early, but do you happen to know when the UA's internal officer elections are going to be in May? Yeah, I mean, probably not. But
the last meeting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was a meeting after the last meeting is what I thought the bylaws were.
No, never mind.
May 5th.
have a quick question. Has the, you're talking about staffing, has the undergrad ranking member been appointed?
Has not. I volunteered, but that's because I'm the only undergrad of our delegation that can make it, and technically I guess I'm not allowed since I'm president of the SA. That's not true.
Is it?
I would have to check.
Because he has to come as the chair of the CJC.
Anyhow.
Anyway, to the meetings.
And none of my other under.
Just, they're two different. one has a role on the executive committee.
Yeah. That's which you can't make it. No one else can make it.
We need an undergrad.
All right.
Full teeth.
Take the bylaws.
Take the bylaws, yeah. We're meeting a week from tomorrow, so we'll decide. Then. Yeah. Any other business? If not, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.